We have a guest speaker with us this morning, Peter Rollins. I heard his name for the first time about 8 years ago, I think we figured out. There was a conference in Grand Rapids that Rob Bell did called Poets, Prophets, and Preachers. And Eric and I went to that and some other people, and we heard Pete for the first time, and we were just wowed. As I remember it, Rob tried to interview you, and you just took over and didn't even let him really talk. It was awesome. And you were sitting on stools, and he'd ask a question, then you'd jump up and walk around the stage, and then he'd try to corral you back in. It was awesome. And then several years ago, I became part of a book club with a couple pastors, Eric and I and a couple others, and we call ourselves the Heretics. We meet on Thursdays, and the first book we ever read was his book, How Not to Speak of God. And I've used him in sermons and stuff before, and so here's what I love about Pete is, I've said before in other places, the mark of a great book to me is not one that just says everything that I already knew or thought before, but one that provokes me to think. And what I've appreciated about Pete over the years is his books cause me to think and provoke my thoughts, and I just, oh, it's so good. And so I can't wait to hear what he's thinking next, because I just know it'll cause me to think. And so that's why we got him here today. Eric's been trying to get him here for a while, so we're really excited. So please welcome Pete Rollins via Belfast to LA to Peoria. So welcome, Pete Rollins.
Thank you. Thank you. I've heard if it plays in Peoria, it plays everywhere. So I don't know if that's it. So this is where I'm testing ground for a sermon. If it works here, it'll work anywhere in the world. That's what somebody said last night anyway. But yeah, that's completely right. Like what I'm interested in is not your agreement. Of course, actually, I do want your agreement. It makes me feel so much better if everybody thinks the way I do. It makes me feel like my insecurity diminishes and lots of little Pete Rollins is running around the world thinking like me and seeing the world like I do. But more importantly than that is, you know, is critical engagement. You know, a bit of an argument, a bit of a discussion. You know, Israel means to fight and to wrestle. And that's why the Irish are God's chosen people, right? Because we like a good fight. We're fighters, not lovers, in Northern Ireland. And, you know, there's an Irish comedian, Dylan Moran, and he said once, he said, war is not conflict. War is the inability to have conflict. So in a war, you can't stand the other person, so you kill them, get rid of them. You know, you can't stand to be in the same room with difference. And then there's the other side of that, which is kind of like where everybody represses their conflict and pushes it down. Everyone's really nice to each other. And someone says, bless your heart, in a way that makes it sound like they're saying, may pestilence fall on you and your family, you know, and all die horribly, right? And you're like, how did they say that? It's all repressed, but it's there underneath. But actually, the healthy thing is for us to engage with difference. When you can't cope with difference, it's often not because you're confident in what you believe, it's because you're not confident in what you believe. You take a book like a book that Rob Bell wrote, actually, you mentioned. He did a book called Love Wins. And Love Wins was rejected by a certain segment of evangelicals. Now, the question you had to ask is, like, vehemently rejected. The question you have to ask is, well, did they disagree with the book? Well, you know, obviously it seemed like they did. They're really angry about it. But then you go, well, hold on, what did the Amish think? Well, they probably don't agree with it. But, like, they don't care. They're just building barns, getting on with life, you know? And you go, okay, so maybe actually the book wasn't something they disagreed with. Maybe it was raising questions that existed within that community, but they were being pushed down. So that means that you vehemently attack. Because often when you attack something vehemently, it's because there's actually something in what's being said that touches on something you've repressed in yourself. I was on a radio show, guy wrote 10 books on apologetics, and he had a show 3 days a week on apologetics, right? This guy was into apologetics, right? He'd read as Josh McDowell. And he was saying to me at one point, are you saying that I should doubt? Are you saying I should doubt? I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not saying you should doubt. I'm saying you're full of doubt. Why else would you have written 10 books on apologetics and have a radio show 3 days a week on it? My goodness, you're repressing something. You know, like, if you're having to do that amount of work, there's something going on. So what I'm interested in is, let's bring that to the surface and having critical and engaged conversation, and not inviting you to agree or disagree with me, But first of all, to maybe just, you know, allow what you're hearing to disturb and surprise you. Because if you agree or disagree with someone, to agree means it fits within your existing paradigm. Oh, what I'm hearing fits within that. And if you disagree, it's like, oh, that doesn't fit within my existing paradigm. So everything's being judged in relation to what you already believe. But often in philosophy, the first thing you have to learn is, how do I stop myself from doing that and allow myself to be surprised and disturbed by what I'm hearing? Allow it to actually crack and fracture my already existing worldview. And then if you go back and still believe what you used to believe, that's great, because you'll be believing it in a slightly different way, maybe a slightly more critical way. So just want to invite us all into that. By the way, I should have said you can all understand me, yes, because I've got this accent often makes it impossible. And often I speak fast as well. We Irish are fast talkers. So I think that's the way I get away with saying what I do, because nobody knows what I'm saying. Right? It's like, just watch this frenetic guy, crazy guy at the front for half an hour who tells jokes every now and again. I'm from Belfast originally, which is, you know, famous for the Troubles, but also we built the Titanic. There you go, not many people know that. We didn't drive it, the English drove it. Wasn't supposed to be put in the icebergs. That's why the Irish don't like ice in their whiskey. So it brings back terrible memories. We're also famous for having a really bad football team that for like 3 years didn't score any goals. And the chant that was done at the football stadium, the chant that we would do to the other side was, "We're not Brazil, we're Northern Ireland." Because the idea is Brazil was like the best football team in the world. And so we're chanting going, you think you're watching Brazil play, right? As they're falling over the ball and not scoring. But actually it's not Brazil, it's Northern Ireland. So, you know, we're famous for kind of some rubbish stuff. But that's part of our spirit as well. Like the motto for the city is not like we will overcome, we will crush our enemies into dust and we will blow the dust into the sea. I know what you are, but what am I? Or something like that. It's how shall we repay so great a debt? That's quite a nice motto for a city. So we're a self-deprecating bunch. I use self-deprecation in talks because it's a way to try and get people to like me. But I'm not very good at it. No. As I said earlier as well, it takes a minute, we get there. That's the best joke I've got today, okay? So we've got another 20 minutes to get through here, so buckle down, lock the doors. What I wanted to chat about today and just introduce is, I mean, it's about Lent, and I'm like a politician. I can make anything that I actually want to say make it fit with what you're actually doing. Like a question, whatever question you ask, I can answer it in a way, make it sound like what I want it to be. But you're doing Lent. We're in Lent. And so in some respects, what I want to talk about is letting go. A lot of Lent is about giving something up. And I want to talk a little bit about that. And I want to use the analogy of a magic trick. Because magicians would use a term in the past, and you'll all know it, hocus pocus, right? At the key moment in the magic trick, hocus pocus, and then something would transform and change. And there was an Archbishop, Tillotson, who noticed that this sounded an awful lot like hoc est corpus, which is what the priest would say during Mass when the bread and the wine were transfigured into the body and blood. And so Tillotson was going, you know what, these guys are mocking the Eucharist. They're taking the mick out of it. They're saying that, oh, these priests are just pretending to be, they're just magicians. They're pretending to be some spiritual kind of thing. But it's just sleight of hand, right? And actually, there's another interesting term that magicians use, which is the patter. You know, when you're talking and you're listening to what they're saying, and as they're talking, they just reach into their back pocket. And because you're mesmerized by their talking, you don't quite notice the movement, right? And that's called the patter, which probably comes from Paternoster, which is what the prayers that the priests or that the monks would have during, in the monasteries, that would lull you into a type of hypnotic state. So these connections with magic and religion. But then Tillotson said, oh, you know, Christianity is not a magic trick. But what I'm interested in is the idea that actually maybe the magicians are right. Maybe the best way to think about Christianity is precisely as a magic trick with three parts. Because the typical traditional magic trick has three elements, and I'm going to actually describe what they are by doing a magic trick. It's because I don't know if the public speaking thing is going to work out for me, so I'm thinking of, you know, kids' parties and that kind of stuff. I'm available for kids' parties. I can do balloon animals. I can very good at intestines, you know. You're not going to be that. This is not going to blow you away. Like, this is not, you're not going to remember this for the rest of your life. But a magic trick has generally three parts, a disappearing act. And the first is what's called the pledge. And the pledge is where there's a coin or some other object that's going to be made to disappear. It might be a dove. You know, if you see a magician who has a beautiful white dove and then it disappears behind it, he puts it in a cage behind covering. A covering, we'll use that word. And then, boom, it disappears. And then, just as you're wondering where it is, you know, it pops out from underneath the magician's hat. These are the three parts. Now, of course, the beautiful white dove that comes out at the end, we think it's the same dove, but it's not. If you've seen the film The Prestige, you'll know this. That first dove is dead, right? Neck's broken, and, you know, magicians have a lot of dead doves. For the kids there, no, it's not true. It is true. So the first thing is the pledge. So here's the pledge, the coin. And I went to Tibet, spent 40 years with a guy up in the mountains, taught me this trick. We fasted the whole time. And what we have to do is, if this works, I rub the coin into my elbow. And it probably disappears. Sometimes it doesn't work. You know, you have to keep going. And then, ba-bam, it disappears. Now, there's about two kids who are 10 years old who think I'm a god at the moment. Everybody else knows probably exactly how I did. I'm going to explain it in a second anyway, but let's just let those kids go, wow, wow, wow. It's pretty impressive, right? So this is the turn. The turn is the disappearance of the object. But there always has to be the third part of the trick. And the third part of the trick is the prestige. So if you're doing this in a pub or something like that, they're going, where is it? And you go, well, you know, take a sip of your beer. And then they lift up the beer. And, oh my goodness, there's the coin, right? Wow, oh my goodness, yes. You can cheer. It's okay. You can clap. Thank you. So, yeah. Now, of course, this coin isn't the same coin that I made disappear, right? What I did was a very simple sleight of hand. Is I was holding the coin in my left hand and rubbing it against the table, doing this. And then at a certain moment, when I think the person's not looking too closely, I put it in my right hand and place it in the back of my neck. While they're hopefully still looking at my left hand, I rub it and it's gone. But really, it's behind my head, right? So that's the magic trick, the pledge, the turn, and the prestige. So in what way could Christianity be understood as enacting these three parts? Well, what I have tried to argue elsewhere is that the pledge of Christianity is the sacred object. What is a sacred object? The sacred object is whatever you think it is that will make your life whole and complete. Whatever it is that you think, oh, if only I had that, everything would be better. Money, or this particular relationship, a kid, religion, whatever it is. Oh, you know, it's like coming to the front. You know, they're playing just as I am. And you go, if I go to the front, everything will work out right, you know. But it's whatever the equivalent altar call is. And it's often not in the religious world, it's in the secular world. Like, if you want to hear talk about, you know, living forever, escaping your corroding body, having all knowledge and all wisdom and being able to travel faster than angels, you know, all of this kind of talk. You don't go to church. You know, you listen to TED Talks, right? This is the new, you know, we'll be able to digitally download ourselves into the cloud and we'll be able to have all knowledge and be able to be in multiple locations. This is these promises are everywhere. Or you take ayahuasca, the new drug from Peru. It's not a new drug, but it's the cool drug in LA. And you'll have oneness with the divine. Or you engage in certain spiritual practices and you'll have this wholeness and tranquility, right? Everyone's promising this. Everyone. Every magazine you open, every movie you watch. It's like the world's a huge vending machine, and in it are all these products that are saying, you have me and everything will be great. And I think what we need to do is take a hammer to the vending machine. But anyway, religion comes in, it puts its product in just beside all the other products. This is the sacred object. And what makes an object sacred, is often that we can't have it. Because when you get it, you realize it doesn't quite work. Sometimes you have to repress that knowledge and pretend to yourself that it works, right? That happens a lot. Like if you look on Facebook and you've got people who put up happy pictures of themselves and their partner, right? That's great. One or two pictures of them being happy on a holiday, that's lovely. They're a happy couple on holiday. But if they're doing 10 pictures a day with 20 status updates about how happy they are, you start to go, oh my goodness, I think they're very unhappy, right? Because they're continually telling you how happy they are. It's a form of what's called denial. It's a defense mechanism. You see it in alcoholism often where, the alcoholic says, I'm not an alcoholic. Now, of course, the problem is if you're not an alcoholic and someone says, Peter, are you an alcoholic? And you go, no. And that's what an alcoholic would say. You go like, well, I'm definitely not an alcoholic. Well, that's definitely what an alcoholic would say, right? It's a bit no. But denial doesn't quite work like that. Denial works whenever the person says they're not an alcoholic when you never even asked, right? So you go, you're at a party and, there's not much drink here. I'm just going to go down the road, get a little bit more for everybody. I mean, I'm not an alcoholic or anything. Well, I didn't ask you if you were. Why are you telling me you're not, So whenever someone's continually having to tell you something, project an image out, often it's a hint that they're not trying to fool you, they're trying to fool themselves, that there's a crisis that's not being looked at. I'll be talking about that tonight, actually, so I won't say very much more. But mostly the thing that we want is at a distance. So we see this in Adam and Eve, right? Walking around this garden, they can do anything they want, and then a prohibition comes down and says, you can eat any fruit, but not that fruit of that tree. And then, of course, it's like, what makes that fruit so magical? Well, kind of partly because you can't have it, right? We all know how this works. You have a kid who says, I want a puppy for Christmas. And you go, you can't have a puppy for Christmas. No, I don't think you understand. Let me say it again. I want a puppy for Christmas. And I can't have a puppy for Christmas. I'm going, okay, I need you to sit down, and I need you to think about this, and I need you to think about what I might do if you say no again. I want a puppy for Christmas, right? I'm going to hold my breath until I pass out, and you don't ever have to buy me any more presents for the rest of my life. I just want the puppy. If I have the puppy, everything will be great, everything will be great, everything will be great. And of course, you get the puppy, and 2 weeks later, not being fed, not being walked, eventually you have to drown it in the bath. Yes. Brings back terrible memories. That was a joke. The dog's in a better place. But you want it because you can't have it. And there's a story that I think captures this, a little story from back home about this high-priced lawyer. This high-priced lawyer who comes to Ireland to duck hunt. So he's duck hunting. And he's out in the forest, shoots a duck, falls in a field. This lawyer goes over to the field. He's getting over the fence. And this farmer, driving along with his hat, sees him and pulls up and says, oh, yeah, mister, you're not from around here. And he says, no, I'm from New York. And, I'm this and I'm that. And, I'm duck hunting and I'm just getting my duck. And he says, oh, is that right now? He says, that's my property there. And the guy's like, I don't care. I'm getting that duck. It's my duck. And he says, oh, is that right? He says, well, that would be trespassing. That's not all. That's my field. And the guy says, you want to stop me? He says, I'm a lawyer. I could destroy you. And this guy, Seamus, this Isle guy, he's like, all right. He says, listen, I'll tell you what. He says, round here we have a way of settling disagreements. Like men, right? Two men. Go like, okay, what is it? He says, it's a three-kick rule. What's that way? He says, one person kicks the other three times, they kick them three times, three times, three times, three times. First person to give up, the other one wins. This guy's in his 30s, and he's looking at this Isle guy. I'm going to totally win this, right? So he says, yeah, okay, come on down. You go first, come on. So Seamus limbers up, and then just from out of nowhere, just kicks the guy between the legs. Guy goes right down on the ground. He's like, whoa. And then hits him on the side. He's winded. He's like, I don't know if I can cope with this. But he's right, one more kick. Kicks him again. He falls into the dirt. And then he gets up and he thinks, okay, now it's my turn. And Seamus says, it's all right. You win. You can have the duck, right? Now, This is... But, you know, the guy really wants it. The prohibition makes the duck really special. It's like, I really want that duck. It's just a duck, right? I really want the duck. And the more the guy says you can't have the duck, the more he wants the duck, and he'll even get kicked around. But as soon as you take the prohibition away and you get the thing, it's like, oh, it's only a duck. Like, this is a piece of fruit. It's not an iPhone 6 that Adam and Eve are, like, wanting, right? That's understandable. This is a piece of fruit, right? But the prohibition makes a mundane object seem, like, really fantastic. And loads of problems arise from this. You know, either we don't get what we think we really want, and it sticks with us for the rest of our lives. Maybe you always wanted to be like a rock star, and you thought, oh, I was doing music when I was young, and then I got married, and it's fine, but whenever you have arguments with your partner, you go back and go, oh, I wish I'd gone and done that. You know, things would have been better. Or whatever it is, there's something in you that, and you don't get it, and it sticks with you. Or you do get it. Like some people I know who did become pop stars or whatever, they did get it, and they was like, oh, that didn't do what I thought it would do. Maybe I need to get bigger, maybe I need to do this. It's what you get never quite does it. Or you fantasize that other people have the sacred object that you don't have. You fantasize that other people are having all this fun and enjoyment while you're not. Like if you break up with someone, and you're sitting in the house wearing your tinfoil hat, collecting urine and bottles, and you're imagining the other person is out having a blast, like having a laugh and partying all the time, right? You're fantasizing they are having the pleasure you're not. Or we pretend to ourselves, like I said with the Facebook example, we pretend to ourselves, but we push down all the stuff that actually doesn't fit with that. This is captured, I think, in another Irish story about a guy from Texas. He's loaded, loads of money, you know, made his fortune in oil. His great-great-grandfather went from the Emerald Isles, went to Texas and made hundreds of millions, billions. And so this guy returns to his homeland. He wants to feel Irish soil, right? And he gets there and he finds out that there's relatives still that he's connected to, and he goes up to one of them. Little guy lives in a farm, right? Knocks on the door, and this guy, old guy, cap on, opens the door. And he's like, how's it going? He says, we're relatives. My great-great-grandfather left these shores, went to Texas and made his fortune. And this guy says, oh, is that right? Very good. He says, my name's Seamus. How's it going? Shakes his hand. He says, oh, Seamus, very nice to meet you. And they go in. He says, have a cup of tea. Do I have a cup of tea? And the big Texan says, yeah, you want to show me around? He says, yeah, come on out. So Seamus goes, oh, you see that? You see that tree stump to the house? He says, that's all mine. And that tractor, that's all right, all to mine. And that fence, that old fence, all of that's my property. And the big Texan guy laughs. He says, listen, back home I can get in my car and I can drive all day north. And by the end of the day, I haven't got to the end of my land. I can drive all day south. I wouldn't hit the border. I could hit all day west, or I could drive all day east and I wouldn't get to the edge of my property. And Seamus goes, he says, I know how you feel. He says, I used to have a car like that as well, right? Like, you know, so what Seamus saw is this guy's pretending, I've got all of this stuff. I've got all of this land, all of this money, all this stuff. And Seamus sees through. He's like, you know, all he sees is a broken guy just like him. He has a broken car just like him, right? And, you know, behind all our projections is often, you know, just a person who's struggling. We're all struggling. If we turn to each other right now and told the other people the things that we've been going through just in the last year, you'd hear amazing stories, incredible stories, you know, and blow you away. And yet it's amazing how we can continue sometimes and do stuff, right? It's amazing. So all of that's there. And this is the sacred object. So what's the turn? The turn is the disappearance of the object. And I argue that in Christianity there's this idea that the sacred object disappears. And think about it like the Wizard of Oz. In the Wizard of Oz there's a curtain, and the curtain is ripped back, and we see behind the curtain and there's just this little guy. Right? It's not some big thing that we thought. The thing that we're separated from, that we think will make us whole and complete, whenever the Wizard of Oz, they're all going to this great wizard who's going to give them what they need more than anything else. And they see behind the curtain and it's not there. Well, you know, Christianity was based loosely on The Wizard of Oz, I've heard. And you have this idea of something similar. You have a curtain, and behind the curtain is the Holy of Holies. It's where, that's where the sacred is. And, hocus pocus, the curtain is ripped back, and we see inside the Holy of Holies, and what is there? And you won't hear this often in church. Nothing. It's not all the socks that you lost in the washing machine. It's not all the coins that were put behind the sofa. It's a room. It's a room. And that's traumatic. The experience in our lives when we realize that you know what, the thing that we thought would bring wholeness and completeness, whatever it is, just didn't work. Like, and you think of religion. Like, I've been in a situation in religion where I felt that you know, if I you know, went to the front and accepted Christ and did all of that, that my life, that would be it. That would be wonderful. And I did that, and it was good for a while. And then it doesn't quite work out. And so what happens? Well, it's just like any product. You have to kind of get updates. You know, it's like, well, you got to read your Bible more, you got to pray more, fast more. And here's the dumb thing. I was that dumb person who did it all, right? Every time they told me that I had to do one more thing and then it would be better, right? Because when you're at the edge of church life, right, you're going, well, if only I did X, Y, and Z, it would be better. And, you know, at the center, if you're, you know, people who are really into it and doing it, maybe they've got this wholeness. Like, you know, they're sitting back there in the office having cappuccinos with Jesus, right? You know, it's like I've been through that door. I mean, no one else can go through that door if you're not a leader. And as soon as you, there's choirs of angels just waiting as you walk in through that door, you know. If only I could get through that door, that would be brilliant. But the problem is when you actually are, you get to the point and you give yourself to it completely and you get behind that door, you realize that you're just as broken as you were before. But it's even worse because now you've got nowhere to go. You go, I did everything. And I still am struggling and have difficulties and joys and sufferings and all of that. But then you're cynical because you're now getting paid and you've got a pension, and so you have to kind of sometimes play the game and pretend that everything's good. And we know it isn't. We know the pastor has loads of doubts and questions, you know, except for yours, you know. It's like, but as long as that's not said, keep that behind closed doors, we all kind of continue to play a certain game. So, you know, there's this sense in which, you know, if only I could do X, Y, and Z, it'll work. But if that's stripped away, it's terrifying. The curtain is ripped away, and you're, oh my goodness, what, I've been forsaken. But the trick doesn't end there. You know, a magic trick doesn't end in the second act. You don't get the applause on the second act. Actually, in truth, I didn't get the applause in the third act. Which is, I noticed, except when I had to manipulate you into giving me them, okay? But technically, you're supposed to spontaneously erupt in applause at the third act of the trick. But you don't get that in the second part, the disappearance. Right? So what's the third part of Christianity? And I would say you capture this in resurrection, which is the return of the sacred. But you don't get back quite what you lost. I know another trick where I get you to take two cards. And I push the cards on you, but I let you show me them as well. So it's the six of hearts and the nine of diamonds. So I give you them, and I go, yeah, show me, it's okay. Six of hearts, nine of diamonds, great. And then I flick the pack, and I go, put one of them in the middle of the pack. You slip one in, close it, and then I do it again, you slip the other one in. And then I just go like this, shake the pack really hard until all of the cards fly everywhere. And I'm holding two cards in my hand. And I flip them over, and they're your cards. You're like, wow, that's pretty impressive. But the secret is, I didn't give you back your cards. I gave you the six of hearts and the nine of diamonds, but I gave you back the six of diamonds and the nine of hearts. You don't notice. You know they're hearts and diamonds, you know they're six and they're nines, and you know they're red, but you don't put them all together. So the cards I have on either side of the pack, so I'm holding those two at the end of the pack. Well, what you're getting back is not quite what you lost. So what do you get back at the end of Christianity, this magic trick? I would say the sacred, not as an object, but as the depth dimension found. So not as an object that you love, but as the depth dimension found in the act of love itself. Right? So now the sacred is found in giving ourselves over to one another in love. The sacred is not something that takes us out of the world, that helps us escape from our lives and our brokenness and our suffering, that causes us to push everything down. The sacred is that experience of depth and density we find in bringing up those things, in bearing witness to them, in sharing them in community, in looking out for each other and caring for one another. And at first it's like, yeah, where's the sacred gone? You know, I've lost the thing that will make me whole and complete, and it seems really depressing. And then you learn, well, what I've got is the people around me and the life that I have. Because there's the freedom to pursue your highest pleasure, and that's a great thing, to have the freedom to pursue your highest pleasure. That's great. But there's something else that's good as well, and that's freedom from the pursuit of your highest pleasure. And that's more difficult. So there's the freedom to pursue your highest pleasure and the freedom from the pursuit of your highest pleasure, which means you go, oh, I'm going to try and learn to just be and to live and enjoy what I have and embrace the people around me. And at first that's a bit depressing. All right. And then you go, actually, this embrace of the mundane is incredibly profound. This is beautiful. You know, I mean, this can sound depressing. People say to me, this is so depressing, like all this darkness and looking at our suffering and all of that. You're trying to make me depressed. And I'm like, I'm not trying to make you depressed. I promise I'm not. I'm telling you, you already are depressed. You just don't know it. Right? And you go like, you know, and at first that can be weird. You go, how can I be depressed? I'm always out. I'm always keeping busy. I'm always hanging out with people. Of course, that's what depressed people do because they can't stand to be alone for 5 minutes, right? You have to keep yourself busy. I know people who have had, you know, trouble sleeping, heart palpitations. They go to the hospital and the doctors go, can't find anything wrong with you. And then they go, actually, you know what? I think you're stressed and depressed. And I'm, no, I'm not. I'm just having trouble sleeping. No, I think you're depressed. No, I'm not. I think you're depressed.
No, I'm depressed.
You know? So that you realize you can't speak it, so your body finds a way of speaking it. If you can't speak your unpleasant truth finds ways to speak. And, you know, you see this at any nightclub you go to, not at maybe 10 o'clock at night, not 11 o'clock at night, but at 2 o'clock in the morning, everyone's having a blast, everyone's having fun, everything's great. But then you spy something. You just look at that person who's just holding on to their drink a little too tightly, and the person who's on their mobile phone, or two people kissing, but they seem unsure about the pleasure they're giving or receiving. And then you think, if you just turned on the lights and turned off the music, and we all had to look at each other for 30 seconds, I think we'd all be crying, right? You know, in the midst of all this fun, it's like, there's something else going on. And the way to overcome that, sadly, here's the bad news, is to tarry with it, to confront it, to bring it to the surface, to share it, to listen to other people who share it. That's really terrible, but actually it's wonderful. That's why I often say the good news of Christianity is life is a bit crap and we don't have the answers. But that doesn't sound like good news, you know? But I'd be like, well, when you say life is great, you can have all of the answers, I can give it to you. And I can give it to you. If you buy my books, you will find wholeness and completeness. You will have all of the answers, right? Now, but no. If I or anybody else says that, it often breeds bad news. It's depressing. It's terrible. You never get it. But if we can embrace life in its complexity, in all of its parts, which is very, very difficult, takes a lot of courage, takes a lot of years. If we can do that, if we can confront our ghosts, because we've all got ghosts, you know, we're all haunted houses. We're all haunted houses. You all got ghosts. Every single one, I can see them in you, you know. The people that you've loved and lost, and people who you've hurt, the people who have hurt you. We all got them. We don't want to confront those ghosts. We push them down, but then they become poltergeists, breaking things, messing things up in our lives. You bring them to the surface, they become holy ghosts. You know, bring them to the surface. It's very difficult. So how does all this relate to the Eucharist, which I mentioned at the beginning? Well, you've got three parts. You've got the sacred object. You know, you've got, here is the sacred, here is the divine, and in a form that you can taste, you can see, you can touch, you can feel, you can smell. The pledge. And then you have the turn. We come up And we take it, and we dip it, the bread and the wine, and we consume it, and it's gone. It's disappeared. And then we go back to our seats, and we try to look holy, and do all of that for a little bit, and think about the day, or whatever. And the music ends, and we get up, and we go for a coffee at the back, and we see someone we haven't seen for a while, and we go, oh yeah, listen, I heard you lost your job. That must be tough. You know, what's going on? Or, oh, I heard you had a child. That's amazing. You know, you need any help? You know, what's going on? And you talk and you chat and you don't just run off. And, you know, you're struggling with something and you don't just say everything's fine. You go, well, to be honest, things have been, you know, a bit difficult. And this is what I'm dealing with. And without even realizing it, something happens. And we find out that we are living the prestige, that the sacred is the depth and density of their life. It's in this conversation that the bread and the wine, the body and the blood are us. We are the body. And that's where God is found, in that sharing life with one another. So often we can use God like someone uses getting drunk. You have a difficult time in your life. You go out, you get drunk, you forget it, you listen to some pop music, whatever, you forget. But it comes back. Oh, it comes back. So you have to go get drunk again. But, you know, in an Irish pub, it's a bit different. You know, well, we've got both bars in Ireland, but there's those pubs that you go and you have a drink and you talk about your week. And there's a singer-songwriter in the corner and they're singing music that actually helps you connect with your suffering. If you go to an Irish pub, there's always someone singing about, you know, unrequited love, you know, some terrible, traumatic thing, you know, it's awful, it's like, you know, where someone loved each other and then they died horribly and all of this. And you go like, why would I want to listen to that? But actually then you go, oh wow, you know, I can connect with a little bit of my own struggles by listening to that. And Kierkegaard said, what is a poet? A poet is someone who screams and cries in agony, but whose lips are so formed that when they cry out, beautiful music is formed. So when we say to the poet, sing to us again, we are saying, may new disasters befall you, right? But in the poets, you hear a little bit of your own struggles reflected back, but in a way that you can cope with, in a way that helps you mourn, you know? You've heard the phrase, gone but not forgotten, which means someone has died, but we remember them, we mourn them. But there's another side to that. Sometimes when someone dies, something traumatic, it's so painful that we try to forget. And this brings us into the realm of the forgotten but not gone. What we try to forget doesn't go. It comes out in other ways. And what we need to do is bring things to the surface and remember. So I want to finish with one story that I think captures this. And it's about a woman who gives birth to a beautiful baby girl, but the child tragically dies after only a few weeks. And so she wraps that child's body in linen. She wraps it to her own, and she goes in search of someone, of anyone who can resuscitate her child. She goes to faith doctors and witch healers, and she goes to the tribal elders, and no one can help. But one of the tribal elders says, high up in the mountains, away from everyone, there's supposedly a holy man who is so close to the divine, he can even raise the dead. Now, perhaps it's a myth, and perhaps he's long since died. No one knows. Haven't seen him for years. I've never seen him. But if you're desperate, go in search of him. And so she does. She's in agony. She doesn't know what to do. She packs a few provisions, and she goes into the mountains. And after a few days, she comes across a single dwelling. She knocks on the door, and an old man answers. And she says, I don't know if you're the one that I'm looking for, and I don't know if you can help me, but my child has died, and I must have her back. Well, the old man takes pity on her. And he says, I'm actually the one you're looking for, and I can help, but I need to concoct a potion. The potion requires ingredients. And one of those ingredients is a handful of mustard seeds taken from a home that has not been burned by that black sun of suffering that has touched your life. Go back into the village and bring me back the mustard seeds and I'll make the potion. So the woman goes back into the village and she goes from home to home, but she cannot find one house, one family that hasn't been touched by death and darkness and brokenness and suffering. And yet, as she listens to the stories of other people's tragedies and overcomings, and as she's gradually able to talk about her own, she finally comes to a place where she is able to bury her child in the earth. You see, she wanted to escape her suffering. The old man knows that and respects that and is sympathetic to that. So he creates a space where she can share it, where she can be honest about what she's struggling with. And in that, she finds healing. Community like this, some people are here because we want easy answers. We, all of us maybe, we all want to escape something. But what we can do is create a space where we are honest about that and we share our lives with one another. And in the midst of that, I think we can find not a life after death. That's neither here nor there for me. I'm interested in a much more important question. Is life possible before we die? Is it possible before we die? Is it possible to have that fullness of life here and now? And I think it is as we learn to be honest and share and bring those ghosts up to the surface.
Can we pray together? God, the illusion in this room this morning is that the people sitting to our right and our left have all their stuff together. That when we get cleaned up and we put on good clothes, that somehow that reflects an inner reality. And the truth of this room is that many of us come into spaces like this and we're so broken and we feel so alone because we don't believe that anybody suffers in the way that we do. So God, into these sacred spaces, help us to be the prestige. Help us to be the people who inhabit you. Help us to give places of comfort and shared experiences to those that we know that hurt. Because as Peter just said and just taught us, that's where you are. That's what faith is. So God, be with us as we act this out this morning, as we say the litany, and as we go through the acts of communion. Help us to remember walking out this door, that the third act happens when we walk out. In your name I pray.